G'day to Mark from Bridgeport in Connecticut and wherever you may be around the world. Thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter and keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Prince Halevi IV.
No, you mean his father's joining what? You. He's in the background.
You again?
Yeah, me again.
Why is he always in the background? When is he going to step into the limelight?
Well, when he starts talking, maybe, and when he knows English.
Oh, there's a start.
So wait, I want to add something. The programs actually are on iTunes?
Yeah, it's on iTunes.
It's like you can actually go to the Apple Store and find recordings by Yoel Halevi or Yoel Ben Shlomo.
I mean, yeah.
That's pretty cool. I can start bragging about that.
Yeah, look, what you do is you go to iTunes, you put in Truth to You Radio, and it should pop up. To be totally honest, I'm not sure how I achieved it. I'm really not the most techie person in the world, but somehow I managed to do it, and it seems to be working, and everyone is very happy about it. So if they're happy, I'm happy. If my listeners are happy, I'm happy. How's that?
So I actually want to know how many downloads I got. I mean, it's kind of funny. I noticed a lot of people who go on the Facebook page, for example, have no idea that there are recordings. They even spoke with people who know me, and they go like, yeah, we know Light of the Prophets. And I said, well, you are aware of the fact that we did a whole bunch of other programs like Kosher Food and Shabbat and everything. Is that really? And it's, yes, we did. You know, and it's kind of funny. So that's when we started. So I'm not surprised some people don't know. A lot of the prophets was really the kickoff of people actually recognizing that I'm doing programs with you.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of funny.
All they have to do is just put in Yoel Halevi in the search there on truth2u.org.
Yoel Ben Shlomo.
Yoel Ben Shlomo. It's your stage name, Yoel Ben Shlomo. And yeah. everything will come up. But, I will get around to organizing the website just a little bit better so it's a bit easier to navigate around. And all of Yoel's past programs, and I mean back in the archives, will be available to flick from an index. But I haven't got around to that yet. But it's on the to-do list, Yoel.
Oh, okay. No, I'm not overly concerned. You know, it's... there are programs that we've done, and I think there's certain subjects that we touched on which are very, very important, because there's certain questions that I get asked over and over and over and over again, and the joke is that people ask you, can you answer this, and I tell them, okay, here's a program I did, you can listen to all the details. And I don't think anyone has ever done a program about what kosher is. I see the whole thing of like biblically kosher, and they show pictures of animals that they consider to be kosher. Some of them are, some of them sometimes are not. Essentially, I don't think anyone's ever done a program about kosher. I don't think anyone's ever done a program about Shabbat. And also insight into Judaism and stuff like that. Insight to Judaism, there is. I mean, there's plenty of websites and everything that you can go to.
Yeah, but yours was a nice all-rounder, as you do on all of those topics that we did. So we will, at some stage, we will put those to index as well, so it's a little bit easier to find. But, if you have, that's a good point. If you have a particular question, put the keywords in the search engine, see what comes up.
Yeah. So actually, one of the classic ones, I'm going to bring this up one more time, please. I think it's kind of ridiculous. I get asked about this all the time because there's a translation problem with this. So when you go to Leviticus 3 and Leviticus 7, they both talk about a fat or fats which are forbidden. And we did an entire program about this, fat and blood. We did this way, way back.
Yeah.
And so I want to just clarify this one more time. The translation translates as fat. Fat, first of all, in English, does not necessarily mean just fat, like, the fat layer, the fat fibers that an animal has in its body. But it can also mean something of a higher quality. Now, if you look at the list of the forbidden fats, if you go to Leviticus 3 and you read through it, you notice that there are some of them are, there's a kidney there, there's a piece of liver, and then there's three fats. So the fat which is on the kidney, the fat which covers the entire digestive system, and a fat that covers the stomach. And in sheep, there's a fat that covers the tail fat, which is used in a lot of sheep product. And if, for example, I pointed out the whole thing of the shawarma, if you go to a shawarma or kebab stand, they have this layer of fat on the top. That's usually sheep, and that's usually from the sheep, from the tails of sheep. And or as some Israelis will say, sheeps.
It's
a long joke that, you know, when I was in high school, we were learning English, you know, and I was bored half the time. But I kept on hearing my classmates going, sheeps. And I have to explain to them, you don't pluralize the word sheep. There's no S in the end or ES or anything. So it was kind of funny.
It occurred to me today while we're talking about the inconsistencies of the English language, it occurred to me today that the, not that I didn't know this, but it just, you know, I just never really thought about it before. The word sugar has no H.
The word sugar, yeah, the word sugar has no H. It's spell better than I do in English. It's sugar. So actually the word in Hebrew and Arabic is sukkar or sukkar.
Really?
Sukkar. And this is probably where the word comes from. Also coffee. In Hebrew and Arabic, kafe or kavi. So a lot of these words do not originate from English. They originate from other languages.
There you go.
Coffee, for example, comes from Sumeria, and they discovered it by mistake, as usual. some of these words are not from European languages, from Indo. Well, they might have traveled with Indo-European languages into Europe, but most of them. Sumerian is actually kind of an issue because it's not a Semitic language. So you can say it probably traveled with the Indo-Europeans into basically Europe. I mean, most languages in Europe, except for Hungarian, I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Well, Eastern European is a bit different, but there's a Slavic languages, but most of the European languages, you know, North Europe,
Hungarian
West Europe.
Hungarian is a most bizarre language. In fact, I said g'day to Mark from Bridgeport, Connecticut earlier on. He and I were having a Hungarian conversation a little earlier on Facebook earlier in the week. But it is. It's a bizarre language.
It's a bizarre language because it's related to Turkish. It's a glutinous language. The construction of words is a bit different. So it's, you know, whatever you hear about it, it sounds funny. It's a really, there's these wobbling sounds and, you know, very continuous. There's no clear stops anywhere.
No, Hungarian. Because, no, like I often say, it's like taking a whole bunch of syllables and throwing them down the stairs.
Exactly. And this is why, for example, Jews who come from Hungary, we usually call them the Ungarn. You can also hear Ungarn. It has like a wobble sound to it. The Hungarian Jews, for example, when they speak Yiddish, no one knows what they're talking about because they mix in a lot of Hungarian words and their accent is completely off because Hungarian has nothing to do with other languages which exist in Europe because it's related to Turkish and the Turks did invade Hungary. But anyhow, forgetting your Hungarian background and everything, putting that aside. A lot of words you find in English, for example, are related to languages that come from this area, from Mesopotamia and South Mesopotamia and Israel. Mm-hmm. Where are we even going with this?
I put you down the rabbit hole with the word sugar and how it has no H in it, but we were actually talking about suet, I think. We were talking about the fats, and you were just clarifying that particular word.
Yeah, so the word is chelev. The word for fat is shuman or shemen. Shemen is actually oil, but shemen, for example, is an adjective for a fat person or fat whatever it would be. And shuman is the actual noun. And the thing is that the Bible doesn't use that. The Bible uses, when it wants to say someone is fat, it says bari. And when it wants to talk about prime cuts, it uses chelev. Chelev ha'aretz tochelu. You know, it's not the fat of the land you will eat. It means the prime of the land you eat. Mm-hmm. So again, it's just very, very clearly, there's no prohibition of eating fat, which is in between the tissues of pieces of meat. There's no chicken fat, by the way. I heard someone was trying to forbid chicken fat. Okay, what we usually call neither schmutz, okay? It's not fat. That's not fat the way it's more of a liquid fat that conjugates at one point when you cook it. Mm-hmm. But when you cook it, then it cools down. But when it comes to four-legged animal, sheep, goat, and ox or cow, whatever it would be, it's only very, very specific types of fats or fatty layers. It's not all types of fat. I mean, I sat with someone and that person ordered the steak and they were eating around the pieces of fat.
That's the best bit.
Well, first of all, on the professional level, it flavors the meat. The two things you have to have for a flavorful piece of meat. One is a layer of fat. Now, not massive layers. I mean, there's a trimming. There's a when you learn butchery in culinary school, if you go into butchery when you go into culinary school, everyone does that. Mm. Some people just become experts in butchery. Some don't. You learn to carve off pieces of fat. You don't actually necessarily throw them away. You can use them for other things. For example, they're thrown into sausages and they give flavor. Mm. But you learn to trim off some of the fat, but some of the fat you leave. So, for example, they're cuts from the animal that don't have that much fat, so you add fat to them. For example, if you're doing a sirloin or a filet or something, they have minimal, if not 0% fat sometimes. So there's a method where you wrap fat around them. But when you're dealing with cuts, for example, from the chest or brisket or a roast or whatever piece you're dealing with, those muscles that work more, mostly from shoulder, chest area, where the lower back is actually more loose. But for example, you go lower back, saying no fat, and then the legs, you go back, you have the rump steak and everything and the mm-hmm. calf, etc. The legs, then there's loads of fat there as well, because those are active muscles, so they develop a layer of fat. Mm-hmm. And you trim some of the fat off, but to have flavor, you actually have to leave some of the fat in. This is why, for example, when you buy very lean cuts, you sometimes have to really put a lot of salt or a lot of seasoning so there's actually flavor, because what you're dealing with is mostly tissue with no flavor. That's number one. But that fat, you don't have to remove. It's only very, very specific types of fat. And the only real fat that you're dealing with is fat on the kidneys, because the two layers on the stomach and the digestive system, these are, it's a colon fat and it's a layer of fat on top. These are mostly like sheets of almost like wet paper. So they don't crumble like paper when you get it wet, but these are the sheets of fat. And they're used sometimes, for example, if you order, if you really go to expensive restaurants and you order a rack of lamb, or if you order lamb chops mm-hmm. or anything, they sometimes wrap it in that colon fat because it adds flavor. So you have to be very careful if you do that. And if they wrap it in colon fat, you have to tell them, don't wrap it in colon fat for me.
Because that's forbidden.
That's forbidden.
Okay.
But that's very long, one last tip. The other tip for flavor in meat is color. If you take meat and just throw it in, dunk it into water or into a soup or something, you don't have that much flavor. This is why browning the meat. Now, there's this whole theory of sealing meat.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very old idea from the 1800s. We don't really know if it's true. We don't know if it really does anything to the juices, because it still drips. Mm-hmm. But when you want to cook a piece of steak, when you want to cook a piece of meat, it's very good to brown it. It's the way you get flavor. So you brown it, and then you have flavor in it. So those are just two tips for cooking, but on the line of what kosher food is. Also blood, by the way. Blood that's inside the meat itself. As an experiment, I've been koshering meat for 22 years. I walked in the kitchen when I was 8 years old, and my mother told me how to kosher meat. And I've been in butcher houses and everything, so I know how to do it professionally. It's not that difficult. The thing is that not all the blood gets drained. There is no way of draining every little drop of blood. I've experimented with different theories that people had and everything. There is no way of draining all the blood out. When you look at the verses in Deuteronomy, it says to pour the blood like water on the ground, mm-hmm. which means that's the blood that's forbidden. Blood mm-hmm. that's inside, you wash off the meat, you can put salt, it kills bacteria as well, but we do not have to drain, like sit there and squeeze, squeeze the meat, like for example, like Gideon did to the piece of wool. You don't have to do that.
Sure.
There's no point in doing that, because it will never work.
Mm.
You will never, ever, ever, ever be able to remove every little ounce and drop of blood from the flesh. There's no way of doing it. This is what Torah specifically clarifies and says. You have to pour it on the earth like water, which means that's the blood that's forbidden. When you cut it, when you cut the animal, the blood pulls out. That's the blood of life. Everything else that's in the tissue is really considered to be part of the tissue. But again, you don't really want to eat that. It's not healthy. So you want to wash off your meat. You want to salt it a bit. It gives a bit of flavor as well. There is a complaint that it dries out the meat. I don't know if it's true.
Yeah, it depends on how much salt you use, really, doesn't it? I mean, if you wash your meat in a salt water.
If you put it in brine or something, it shouldn't dry out your meat or anything.
Hmm.
But there is no way on earth to actually drain every drop of blood out of meat. There's no way of doing it. I've experimented. My wife and I went through several years of experimenting with these things. We even cut the meat to small pieces, and we tried, and it didn't work.
So there it is. There it is in a nutshell. And if I remember correctly, Yoel, I think it was called The Issue of the Fats and the Blood, if I remember correctly. People can find that. If they put that in the search engine, you'll find that in much more elaborate detail. And so thank you for clarifying that. That's a frequently asked question, right?
Yeah, people are concerned about it because, you know, the prohibition of eating blood appears with Noah and his family. It's repeated many times in Leviticus and certainly about three or four times in Deuteronomy. And people are concerned about it. And
that's commendable.
And I understand that. So here I'm answering again. Not too sure how many times I've done it already. But
always come across new information and they want to know. So there it is. And thank you for clarifying that. Now, while we're clarifying words, last week, Yoel, I used the – we were talking about – speaking of fat, we were talking about Yasser Arafat and how they were digging up his old bones and doing what I called a toxicology report. And I think we're still waiting on the results of that. But you know what? It bugs me all week. I was thinking, in the back of my mind, toxology, I don't think that's the word, toxology. And so this morning I looked it up, and lo and behold, it's toxicology. A toxicology report is what they're waiting for. Do you know what toxicology is?
Well, enlighten me.
Well, toxicology is the study of archery.
Really?
Yeah, apparently.
So I've heard people use the word toxicology for... What was the other one? Toxicology or something?
Toxicology, yeah, that's right. So toxicology is...
I think I've even seen TV programs make that mistake.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, it's probably a very easy mistake to make, as I did last week, but I don't think they're going to be digging up his old bones to see how many arrows are in him. although it brings... Well, no, I shouldn't...
No, but the thing that no one's talking about is the fact that, well... They can dig it. It was someone from the PA who dug out the bones, which means we don't know if we can trust them.
That's what I mean. They can decide. I want to know that because I was so the Israeli scientists don't get a piece of him and get to sample him as well, or what?
No, they're not giving it to us. It's all a game. They're gonna come out with a declaration that he was poisoned. And if they come out with a declaration he wasn't poisoned, they'll say, oh, it's a fake. Israeli's gonna involve somehow. It's all a game. And this is what's going on. And I've said this over and over again. It's a game on the lives of Jews, on the lives of people around the world. And now that, you know, Bibi Netanyahu is basically snubbing the UN decision from was it Thursday? It was for us. It was Friday. It was the day before. It was basically leading into Friday already. Basically, he snubbed it and said, we don't care. And that's the way we should go. And now, no, you know, they're doing everything they you know. So we have a state now. No, you don't. It doesn't work like that.
There wasn't a state to begin with. And then Bibi said, okay, 3,000 houses approved. Get building. But the thing I don't understand, Yoel, why we're talking about this, and we've been on Shmooze for too long, but was it Migron?
There was a place called Migron, yes.
Okay, and it was dismantled just recently, right?
Several months ago, yeah.
What now that must be a real kick in the teeth because... Remind everyone where Migron was, or is.
So Migron was on the Route 60 leading towards Shechem. It was actually on a hill next to the road itself. It was not too far away from Bet El, which is a place that Keith Johnson and I actually went filming one time. Uh-huh. There were about 50 families living there. And there's a bunch of traders here in Israel called Peace Now and other bunches as well that basically traitors to the state, they're traitors to the concept of being Zionist and traitors to the concept of being Jewish. Mm-hmm. And they run around and they help Arabs, but they incite Arabs to file legal actions against Israelis, mostly settlers. You know, thing is that people say settlers, but if you go to an Arab... Most Arabs in the PA think that even people who live in Tel Aviv are settlers. They think that they're not interested just in Judea and Samaria. If you look at the PA flag, the official symbols, they have the entire state of Israel as part of their flag in green, and that speaks volumes of what they actually want to do.
It does, and somehow, Yoel, the government bowed to pressure and dismantled Migron and. You say 60 families. There were more than 200 people there, I think.
There were hundreds of people living there. I was there. I mean, Migron has been there for 15. It was there for 15 years. And from day one, they were talking about dismantling it. It was there for 15 years, and people already, you know, I don't think there were any permanent structures there. Mostly, you know, mobile homes and stuff like that. But I remember I was there 12 years ago or 11 years ago, and they were talking about, we're not going to go away anywhere and everything. And the thing is that basically what happens here, there's a struggle. There's a struggle in between the cult and the struggle in between the government. The government here in Israel is right-wing. Well, the courts are governed by extreme leftists. And the thing is that there's a check and balance that exists in most democracies. So, for example, the government can do something, but it's the government makes a law. And it's kind of like it's the job of the court system to decide what that law means. But if the court makes a mistake or misinterprets what the government meant, the government has the right to step in and say, no, this is not what we meant. We meant this and this. Mm. But the court decides that they're going to ignore this. So they've been talking about changing the court system a lot, and I don't know if anything has really changed. I have not seen for quite a while too many articles against the court system, which means something has probably changed. Mm. But there was no actual proof that this Arab owned this piece of land. They just walk in and claim that they do. One of the classic ones is like, there's a patch of land, for example, literally 200 feet away from where I live. And we're not allowed to build this small patch of land. We're talking about, you know, I don't know, really, really small. Mm. And we're not allowed to build anything there. Why? Because there's some Arab who showed up and said that his family's been grazing there for 100 years on that little patch there.
Mm.
You know, and that's what they do. And there's no way of proving it. They're just, they're saying, oh, this is what we do. So there have been court cases where basically people said, well, I've been living on this, I've been working this piece of land for 15 years. It's mine now. Mm. But the thing is that they're using a Turkish law here that allows anyone to claim that except for Jews.
Really?
So the whole thing is ridiculous. Everything here in Israel, law-wise, when it comes to the disputes over land and everything outside the green line, it's completely loony.
It seems loony to me because, as I was saying, it must be a real kick in the teeth to the people of Migron who had their houses and community dismantled and basically hoisted out homeless and left to find another place. While only a few months later, the government then says, "Right, 3,000 new buildings. We're going to build it." Okay.
So there's a bit of a row about that as well, because these are called E1 areas. There's a bit of a dispute in between the PA and us who owns that piece of land. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that there's a place called Maale Adumim, which is a pretty – I mean, we're talking about a city. This is no longer a settlement. This is a big city. I've been there many, many times. It's a huge place. It is not small. It is a huge place with large structures. People, you know, you have apartment buildings there, hundreds of apartment buildings. There's thousands, I mean, tens of thousands of people living there. And the Arabs are going, no, we own that. You know, we've been sitting on that land for 20 odd years. We've been building there for 20, 30 years. That's basically when Maale Adumim started. And they're basically trying to, you know, claim everything belongs to them. You know, that's really the methodology, and this is why I'm basically claiming that the UN has to be dismantled, because it's no longer serving the purpose of what it originally was, which was a committee of different nations. Now it's mostly controlled by communists and states and Arabs who are in league with one another anyhow against the democracies of the West. So they're basically holding the democracies of the West tight down and forcing them to do anything. If you actually look at the list of countries that voted for the PA, these are mostly communist countries and Arab countries. If you look at the list of the countries that refrained from doing it, then you realize.
Yoel, do you know that our prime minister?
Your country. They all chickened out. This is what happened.
She chickened out. She was going to vote no, and then the pressure came on her, and then they chose to abstain, which really, I mean, at least they didn't vote for, but I mean, you know, it's unfortunate.
So 41 countries decided to abstain, and most of those countries are European countries, mm-hmm. which is very, very interesting. What's very interesting as well is the reaction towards the U.S., The U.S. has been working on trying to bring peace in between the PA and Israel for many, many years. Mm. They're a lot more involved in what's going on. They know a lot more. So suddenly this Finnish idiot shows up and says, you know, he goes, well, it's because the Jews control the money and the – what? And you sound like Goebbels, seriously. I mean, you sound like Goebbels and other neo-Nazis. You know, I basically posted on Facebook and I said, this is the real reason why they voted yes for the PA. is because or they abstain because they're a bunch of anti-Semites. It has nothing to do with truth. It has nothing to do with anything. It has to do with their pure hatred towards Jews. And it's not me being paranoid or anything. I can get up and leave Israel whenever I want. I can move to almost any European country. I have an EU passport. I can move to the United States if I want. I don't and petition for a green card. You know, that would be very easy as well. But I'm not doing that. I'm not paranoid. I'm not afraid of anyone. I'm just pointing out very simple facts.
Amen. And while we're talking about it, g'day to everybody listening in the Czech Republic who voted no. Like a little, you know, when you look at the map on Wiki.
Go Czech Republic.
Go Czech Republic. The little purple dot on the map on Wiki as to where the votes went. That's the Czech Republic, if you're wondering. So good on you guys. We better start, my friend, because we've been schmoozing for a while, and you thought that we were going to get through 9 and 10. I really doubt it now, but...
Yeah, it's all your fault. You've been pushing the schmoozing. I'm using the power of Jewish guilt.
First Samuel chapter 9. Hey, yeah. So Yoel, there was a man of Benjamin, whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorat, and the son of Afiach. A Benjamite. Now get this. It says, a mighty man of power. Is that what you've got in the Hebrew?
So it says Gibol Chai, which means a hero of valor or something. We're talking about, you know, important people and people of strength. You know, we're not talking about some simple people. This is an important family. What's very interesting here is that this is one of those rare cases. We had this in the beginning of the book of Samuel when we're talking about Elkanah, where they give the full genealogy and exactly where he lives and everything. Mm-hmm. It's the exact same thing here. We have the full family. It's Kish, the son of Avier, the son of Tzero, the son of Bechorah, the son of Afiach, from the house of Benjamin. So they're not going all the way up to Benjamin, but they're going through quite a few generations. It's like one, two, three, four generations up. That's 150 years into the history of the family. Basically, these are sons of Benjamin. So we already had sons of Benjamin as being pretty serious fighters when we were dealing with the concubine on the hill.
They're good with the sling.
They're very good at this thing and everything, and these are you know, mighty people. These are people of valor. They're not a bunch of nobodies or anything.
No,
and this
serious.
kind of gives you an idea of one of the options of who a king could be. Because when you go to King David, you know, they talk about Yishai or Jesse, his father, and everything, but no one really knows. You know, Yishai was kind of important, but for himself, it was because of himself. He was an elderly man, he was wise and everything, but they don't really talk about the genealogy of his family. And here, it's the opposing idea where we actually go through the entire, you know, look at this, men of valor, these are strong men, these are important men, they're, you know, we can trust them. And so they're saying, okay, here's one option of what could be a king. Here's a very important family, a very strong man, people of character and everything. And attempt number one with a king, actually attempt number two already with a king, because we had Gideon or Yerubal in the book of Judges.
We're gonna touch on him too a little later on. But while you were talking about the ancestry of Jesse, of King David, Ruth, chapter 2, verse 1. Is it the same wording? It says, I've got...
Let me go there.
You look it up.
Second.
You look it up. This is what I have in English.
Second.
It says there was
wait,
a...
Wait.
I'm just going to read it for the people while you look it up. It says there was...
I want to see it. Was it 1, verse 2?
2, verse 1. It says...
Yeah, okay, I got it. Yeah, it's the exact same words.
It's the exact same words. There was a relative of Naomi's husband. I've got a man of great wealth...
Well, he was of great wealth as well. So Gibol Chayil, I don't know if it's necessarily wealth here. I mean,
so power is a better word.
So Chayil, it goes like this. Chayil in biblical Hebrew means wealth. Gibol means mighty. So maybe a Gibol Chayil means a mighty and wealthy man. Someone who's worth trusting.
Okay. So there it is. So this is where we are. And he had a choice and handsome son, Yoel, whose name was Shaul, and there was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. Sounds like me.
He was considered to be tall. He says here in the end.
He was tall and handsome. What are you talking about?
Well, I don't know about handsome. I mean, remember, I've never met you face to face. I can't decide yet, but I'll tell you in about 3 months when we meet up. No, but he was considerably tall. But what is exactly his tall? I mean, for example, here in Israel, I walk around the street and there's a lot of tall people. Mm-hmm. But most people are not as tall as I am, for example. I actually once walked with Nehemiah into a place, a diner of sorts, and I walk in, and these two guys are like, you know, looking at Nehemiah and I, and they're like, you know, I get up to wash my hands before we eat, because we were dealing with things outside, and it was just hilarious. It was, this guy walks out, he's like, yo, how tall are you? I'm like, oh, 6'3", you know, I'm not that tall. I mean, I have a brother who's taller than me. I have a brother-in-law that's, you know, it's a lot taller than I am. I once met a guy who was almost 8 foot. You know, this guy was huge.
That is
huge. You know, no, but in Israel, you know, essentially, you know, Jews or Israelites or Semites in general are relatively, you know, in between 5'3" to 5'8". That's the average height of a Semite. And mm-hmm. when you have someone who's over 6 foot, you know, 6'1", 6'2", then people start to consider them, they start standing out.
Yeah, so I'm 6'5", and it says exactly here that that Shaul, from his shoulders upward, he was taller than any man of the people. From his shoulders, yeah, well, that's decent.
Well, Shechemov Amala, I don't know. Shechemov Amala here, I don't think refers to his actual height. It refers, Shechemov Amala is a term. It's actually a, the word
his
I'm looking
statue?
For
his character and statue.
It has to do more with this. It's a metaphor, which I think the word I'm looking for is metaphor.
Yeah.
It's like a proverb that people use when you want to say someone's like a good man. He's worth.
He's,
you know,
outstanding. He's an outstanding.
So you say Mishichamov Amala, from his shoulders up. He's greater than everyone else. So I don't think that refers to actually his height. What it refers to his height is actually, it says Mishichamov Amala. And it kind of alludes to the issue of his height, but it's mostly talking about his character. But then the writer of the verse decided to shift to actually, okay, here's an actual reality. He actually was taller than everyone else.
Okay.
So he was basically, in other words, he was tall and handsome and brave.
Got it. And now the donkeys of Kish, Shaul's father, were lost.
So Atonot, the Aton is actually the female of the donkey.
There it is. And so Kish, he said to Shaul, listen, take one of your servants with you and arise and go and look for the donkeys. And so he passed through the mountains of Ephraim and through the land of Shalisha is what I've got. Boy, that's a nice...
Shalisha.
That's a beautiful name of a... I mean, do you know where that is?
I actually went through that area once quite a few years ago just to see... It's a very hilly area, the land of Tzuf and all this entire area. It's a very, very hilly area. Actually, most of the time you're walking around in valleys, which would make sense why they had atonot, why they had donkeys, because donkeys are very, 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 very good in hilly areas.
Sure.
Exactly where the land of Shalisha is, exactly where these different locations mentioned here exactly are, we don't know.
Oh, so it's not a town today, for example? There's not a community in Shalisha today?
We don't really know of any communities in Shalisha, but this is all inside. What we do know is it's all inside of the Benjamite areas, and it's a very, very hilly area. Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful hills. I mean, they look like they're like funny, like dome type of hills when you see some of them, like almost like a dome.
As if they've been crafted, you know, nicely rounded off. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it feels like that sometimes. When you travel between these hills, it's very interesting. They're very steep, but they're very beautiful. I mean, you have like patches of rocks and you have like shrubs and everything and plants all over the place. It's a beautiful area to be at.
I'm looking forward to getting there and having a look around, my friend, that's for sure. But I like the sound of the name Shalisha. And also it says they didn't find them and then they passed through the land of Sha'alim. Is that correct?
So Sha'alim... It's from the word Sha'al, and the Sha'al actually has to do with a road. So I don't know exactly what they mean, the land of Sha'alim. I mean, there was one interpretation, one saw that Shalisha means south, and Sha'alim is the desert. But what exactly they mean by these names, I don't know. But a Sha'al is actually a pathway of sorts. Eretz Sha'alim might have been a crossroad area.
Crossroads.
Maybe.
Yeah, I was going to say probably a crossroads, it sounds like. In any case, they passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they did not find them. And when they had come to the land of Zuf,
so, So what's, by the way, if you look, if you notice, well, you don't really see in the English, but in verse 4, it uses twice. It uses the verb to pass, avar, ein bet resh, in the single, and only in the third case it mentions the plural. Mm-hmm. And I actually once saw someone, and they claimed that this is part of the character of Saul. He didn't look at himself as being very important. He knew he was tall, he knew he was handsome, he knew he was brave, blah, blah, blah. But he's going around with his servant, but he and the servant are walking together.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of, they're trying to emphasize his character, that he actually was kind of pious. He didn't see himself above anyone else. That's mm-hmm. that's one of the things one of the claims I've seen about how the verb is used. I mean, again, you have single, then suddenly plural. That's okay. But they're saying, one of the things I saw is that they're saying it's, the reason it's in the single is because it's trying to emphasize his character. And we see this actually along the line as well, when they decide to go and speak with Samuel himself.
Yeah, that's right.
They're having a discussion and.
And that's the sense that I get from that too. And so he says to his servant, you know, because they come to the lenses of, he says, you know, we better go. We can't find it. He said, my father will cease caring about the donkeys and become worried about us if we don't get back. And the servant said to him, he said, now look, there's a city, there's a man of God, and he is an honorable man, and all that he says surely comes to pass. So let us go there. Perhaps he can show us the way that we should go.
So there's a few interesting things. First of all, it's called the land of Tzuf. Mm. So I once saw a commentary that says the reason it's called the land of Tzuf at this point is because it's the land of the Tzofe. Tzuf, Tzofe. It's the same. Oh, it's not the same root, but it's similar sounds. And they're trying to say that, oh, this is the land of the Tzofe, which is the man who sees, which is kind of like a nickname for Samuel. The other option is that the land of Tzuf is a land that you have hills there and you can actually view from there. That's another option. This is another option why they called it that.
Okay.
But what's interesting also is the concern that Saul has about his father. He has a lot of respect to his father, what it seems like. He says, I'm actually more concerned that my father will start worrying about us, so I think we should go home. But the servant is like, no, we have to find these mules or whatever you want to call them. These atonot, and he starts giving advice, which is kind of unusual, because if he's a servant, you know, how dare he even talk? I mean, he doesn't even do an introduction. May I speak? Or he just immediately, you know, interjects in what he says.
It just seems like they're mates and they're conversing together, and there's no problem with that. They're equals.
And he cuts him off. He says, oh, there's a man of God there. And it's, you know, there's a question. How does he know there's a man of God there? I mean, we looked at Samuel, and it mentions that Samuel goes around. How did he know that there's a man of God here? And what's very interesting as well is the entire sequence here. It's part of what's going on here as well is it's trying to teach you that there's no chance in the world.
No coincidence.
Things happen. There's no coincidence. Things happen for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
The animals vanished. His father decides to send Saul. Why Saul? God knows. But he sends Saul, and he specifically sends him with a specific servant who's kind of has a good relationship with his master. And only that, the servant is so comfortable with his master that he can cut into his master's information, telling him, well, I know there's a man of God. Now, how does he know there's a man of God there? How is it that specifically they're there?
We don't know how he was privy to that information, but I did find it interesting that Shaul didn't know.
Well, there is a way. I mean, first of all, Shaul is his business. He does his father's business. He doesn't hear all the rumors and everything. So there's a good chance that the servant heard from other people. Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, Samuel's going to such and such city.
Sure.
But it's funny is that Saul, it's not funny, but Saul decides to give up the search not too far away from that specific city. Mm-hmm. And it happens to you that specific servant knows about Samuel going to that specific city. So there's a strong emphasis here of, you know, nothing is coincidence. Nothing is coincidence. Mm-hmm. And at one point, we discover it actually, you know, now at the moment we're just dealing with the storyline. Then we flip over to Samuel's end, and then we get the insight, and Samuel knows.
We get the confirmation.
Get the confirmation.
But even before the confirmation, there's Shaul starts reasoning with his servant, right? Just having the conversation. He says, "But look,
he's arguing.
He's arguing. He's saying, but if we go, what should we bring the man?" And he's saying, "Hey, you know, that's an interesting idea. Maybe we should do that. We don't have anything to give him. All the bread in our vessel is gone. And there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have?" And this really strikes me, Yoel, because the relationship between Shaul and his servant is such that even his servant says, hey, I've got some silver. Hey, use my silver, you know. Like, they really seem like they are their mates. Maybe they've known each other since they were really, really young. And he looks, he says, I have some silver. It's just, you know, 1/4 of a shekel of silver, and I'll give that to the man of God, and he'll tell us our way. And then there's an explanation in verse 9, which my English version puts in brackets. Do we want to go there, or did you want to comment on that?
So just very, very quickly, first of all, there's a thing about Samuel. He actually doesn't take gifts from anyone. So this is like Saul trying to avoid the whole thing. I mean, it was actually well known that Samuel does not take gifts, and he points it out. He does the same thing that Moses does. He turns around and says, I've never taken any donkeys from anyone, any money from anyone, nothing. I've been doing this as a work of God.
Mm-hmm. And, but maybe it was customary of a quote-unquote seer.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So it was customary in the ancient world that when you go to get a spiritual advice, you usually give a gift because, you know, this person focuses their energy and their abilities and their time to answering people's questions, whatever it would be. Like, for example, you know, you have a Torah teacher and, you know, they put the time into studying so they can answer the questions. Mm-hmm. So it's customary to go and, you know, when you ask a question, it's customary to give something, mm-hmm. you know, but it's not that you have to. That's part of the issue. You don't have to give.
Sure.
There's only very specific cases where you have to give someone something. We're talking about tithe to Levites and certain presents to the priests, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. gifts you can give to the temple. But we're not talking about that you have to. But it was customary to give. You know, you have someone who's a professional religious person. Though in the Israelite structure, the Levites are the professional religious experts, mm-hmm. while the Kohanim, the priests, are the temple experts. Mm-hmm. But it was customary in the ancient world to do that. So he says, I got a quarter of a shekel. Now, by the way, a quarter of a shekel is actually quite a bit of money. It wasn't, you know, we're not talking about, you know, we're talking about a few grams of silver, but it was still money. It was still worth something.
Oh, sure.
The other thing is that you have in brackets, and I don't know why it's in brackets. Yeah. Now in verse 9, what it happens, it says that it's kind of like giving us an interjection here of what was customary done. So what was customary? They said before that in Israel, they used to, when a man would say, when he went to seek God, we shall go up to the ro'eh, to the ro'eh. Now a ro'eh is not a navi. Okay, the word for prophet is navi. Mm-hmm. The word ro'eh means a seer. So it kind of gives us an idea what prophets were like at the time. These were not the prophets that we have as, for example, the canonized prophets, the written prophets like Isaiah and everything, mm-hmm. that their message was written, their message was international. The prophets at the time, it says the seer, for the prophet at the time they would call a seer. Now that's, by the way, in the Hebrew Bible, and this shows up as this is verse 9, and it's not put aside or anything. Mm-hmm. But what's very, very interesting, it also gives you kind of an idea of what prophets were like. They weren't necessarily prophets as, you know, a speech prophet that was standing in a court or standing in the marketplace and started yelling out words of prophecy. These were people that people would go to seek God for. Mm. And you have a similar example like this, for example, Huldah the prophetess. Devorah as well, the prophetess. Mm-hmm. They were both mostly seers. They sat in one place and they would give the word of God to people who come to them. And Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, even Isaiah, they mentioned this, that they were professional spiritual seers. These were people that you gave them money and they would see the future for you. So it's kind of like the same idea, but these were men of God. And this is why Isha Elohim, the man of God, is emphasized here several times, one after the other, to give the difference in between, you know, what a man of God is and just a seer. Mm. And it's actually an interjection and telling you, it's actually a prophet. What we call today, because it shows this was written decades, maybe even centuries later, what we call a prophet today, they called a seer. But it also gives you the function of what they were.
Could you, I mean, from an outside perspective, would someone say, is it unfair to say that they, I mean, could someone say a clairvoyant?
A what?
A clairvoyant or a medium. I mean, someone who speaks, not a medium, I wonder if clairvoyant is the right word. Let me look that up. Hold on a second.
What is a clairvoyant? I've never heard that word before.
No, I'm going to look it up and just make sure that this is okay, here we go. Definition. The term clairvoyance from French clair, meaning clear, and voyance, meaning vision, clear vision, is used to refer to the ability to gain information about an object or person, location, or physical event through means other than known human senses. Would that fit the definition of a seer?
This sounds kind of complex, but kind of. Yeah, I think the answer could be yes on this one.
Yeah. So now, I mean,
very long description.
Yeah, we wouldn't use that word in the Tanakh in the English, of course, because it carries the connotation of a very sort of pagan feel about it. But it's interesting that in that day, that was the role that at least some prophets would fulfill, and that wasn't unusual. And yeah. and in this case, we do see Samuel fulfilling that role. So that's an interesting thing to think about.
Now, the other thing is that this is an introduction to the next. It's actually giving us now the terminology that's about to be used in the next couple of verses.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it says, then Shaul said to his servant, "Well said, come, let us go." And so they went to the man, went to the city where the man of God was, and as they went up the hill to the city, they met some young women going out to draw water, and they said to them, "Is the seer here?" And they answered, and they said, "Yes. Boy, you're handsome." Oh, I mean, they said, "Yes, he's over there, just ahead of you. Hurry now, for today he has come into the city because there's a sacrifice for all the people today on the high place." Now, I've got to stop there, Yoel.
So we have to stop here for several reasons. First of all, you just said something there which is pretty clever, because there's actually a midrash. The reason they're talking and talking and talking, because if you notice, they have two verses, one of them very, very long, that the girls are talking with him. Mm-hmm. And there's a midrash that says that the reason they did this is because he was good looking. So they actually wanted to continue looking at him.
Sure.
That's number one.
They were very, very keen to offer information, Yoel.
Yeah, but the other thing, the well. The well is kind of like the meeting place, mm-hmm, for future grooms to see different possible brides. Exactly, Rebecca. That's another part of it. Mm-hmm. So going to the well was, women in the Bible considered to be chatterboxes. So you can get any piece of information you want when you. I mean, seriously, this is part of the characterization
where you
of
go
women.
And, get the update.
Yeah, that's where you go to get updated, and who's the best people to know. Usually, you know, they say that usually. I mean, I'm not here to insult anyone. I'm probably going to annoy a whole bunch of women here as well. But it was considered in the ancient world that women were the chatterboxes, and they knew all the rumors and everything, and they were the ones who carried all the gossip. And you know something? Even in the modern world today, in the Western world, you know, you watch a movie and they talk about women are the ones that gossip. Though I think men gossip as well, but men also have this like a distance type of thing. If you're a man, you don't necessarily talk about other men, what they're doing. But this is the local billboard, you know. This is where you get information. This is the radio, the TV, whatever you want. And there's another thing here, based on some syntax analysis that's been done on these two verses. They claim that there's not one speaker here. There's a whole bunch of speakers. They're all. I don't really necessarily see it.
Well, but it says they answered them, and so you could have one saying, yeah, there he is, he's just ahead of you, hurry now. Another one might have said, hurry now, for today he's come to the city because there's a sacrifice of the people today on the high place. And another one could have said, as soon as you came into the city, you will surely find him as he goes up. And then another one could have said, for all the people. I mean, each sentence could have been attributed to another woman.
Exactly. That's a possibility, because they're all sitting there and all giggling. It's like, ooh, he's a handsome man. They're all trying to interject a sentence there so he notices them. Because, you know, he's gone to the well. Maybe he's looking for a wife. And this guy's good. A model. This guy looks good. So this is probably what's going on. But the thing is that you can say that, oh, and they answered him, but it's possible that they chit-chatted between them and one of them answered. But it's going to say they've all answered. But based on some structural issues here with these two verses, they claim that really like each section is by a different girl. And part of the possibility, one of the possibilities is that they were all trying to say something because they wanted him to notice them. So... when you want to find a woman, you don't hit the bars, you hit the well.
So that's and there is a bit of detail, but twice they mention the high places. Now, I've got to go, Yoel, to Numbers 33, verse 52. It says, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants from the land from before you and destroy their engraved stones and destroy their molded images and demolish their high places. and so on and so forth. It goes also in Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 2 and on. It says, you shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree and so on and so forth. You should break all that stuff. You shall not do, it says, you shall not worship the Lord your God with such things, in Deuteronomy 12:4. So here we are, though, and it says that there's a sacrifice in the high place and that he's going up there to eat.
So what exactly is the issue here? So if you go, for example, to Mendenhall, for example, this is an example, he'll say, oh, this is proof that they developed from polytheism into monotheism, and you know, it just took time until they really developed the monotheism thing. So they had, you know, altars, the old customs of what they did. That's not really what the Bible says. The Bible says that actually it was one place that they worshipped at, but people went to different places. But here, it's Samuel. He's the man of God. What is going on? So it's a very good question. So one of the answers that's been given about this is that when Shiloh was destroyed, and we're only talking probably several decades after Shiloh was destroyed, they didn't really reestablish the tabernacle. And when they didn't reestablish the tabernacle, they were technically allowed to have small altars or public altars scattered around the country instead of one centralized altar. Mm-hmm. But there are multiple issues here, which I've been trying to figure out for several years already. I've been studying this subject for quite a while, and it's strange. So, for example, the sages say when Shiloh was destroyed, they were allowed to use high places or, you know, bamot, you know, elevated places, mm-hmm. and when the temple was built, it was forbidden. And the fact remains that we see quite a few characters at the time, important characters, who are using these high places and not going to the tabernacle, not going to the place where the ark is. And the ark is actually sitting in someone's house. It's still there. It's mm-hmm. sat there for 20 years. So there's a lot of questions here that have been asked. And the possibility is also that at the time there was a certain level of confusion because of the time of the judges, that each person did whatever they wanted. And they continued the practice. And we see this practice was continued into the first temple period, that they had these high places and people did not want to give them up because mm-hmm. they had a tradition that this is how you worship God. But this might have been a corrupted tradition, or a tradition that was allowed for a time when they didn't have a tabernacle in Shiloh, or they didn't have a permanent temple. So there are a lot of discussions, a lot of different opinions.
And also, it's fair to say that their intention, it may well have been that their intention was pure and there was no problem.
Exactly. But the other thing is that you have to remember that the Torah, this one place where the Torah points out this whole thing of the resting place and everything, mm-hmm. to the resting place and the inheritance, mm-hmm. and that kind of hints to the idea that maybe that the only time when you have one place to worship is only when you have a finalized place that you stop and you build something permanent there. Mm-hmm. But again, the whole issue of development of sacrifices, of altars in Israel, is a pretty massive field of research that I've looked into a couple of times already. There's no straightforward answer. There's a lot of things that were done in the first temple period that don't really fit, for example, the book of Deuteronomy.
Sure.
It just doesn't fit the one
site. And so that's a valid point that you make, that when the place that he chooses to put his name is no longer functioning for whatever reason, do we revert back to what they were doing before? It's really interesting to think about. We might have to do a program on that sometime. I know that's been ticking around in your mind for a while.
Well, we mentioned this. I mean, I, when we did the program about the Temple Mount, I was explaining about what the Temple Mount is and everything. I didn't mention this man that I met that basically said, well, we don't really have access to the Temple Mount. We don't, you know, it might be the eternal house, but we don't really have any access. But, you know, the Torah still commands to build, you know, to have sacrifice and everything. So why don't we go back to Shiloh? Why don't we establish a place of worship wherever we, you know, wherever? You know, why are we insisting on the Temple Mount? And I went back and forth with this man. I was basically saying, you know, well, the issue is that, you know, this is the eternal house. But there are elements that we can sit down and have a discussion about. But the thing is, you have Ezekiel. Ezekiel talks about the third house, or the temple of Ezekiel, they all talk about returning to Jerusalem, and Jerusalem will be the place of glory and everything. So there's this element, a very, very strong element of going back to Jerusalem. But he kept on insisting that, you know, we can't build anything, but the Torah still commands us. And he says, if the Torah commands us, we have to do this. And we have a prophet talking about a future, but that future hasn't come yet. Why are we sitting around saying, well, we're not going to bring sacrifices? And I basically said, well, we can go into, this is circular reasoning. We can't really, I can't really answer such a thing because he has a valid point. But on the other hand, we do have the words of the prophets talking about a future temple, talking about return to Jerusalem and everything. But, you know, and in the Jewish mindset, in the mindset of many people, you know, Jerusalem is the place, this is the eternal house. And if you sacrifice outside of the chosen place, you're committing an offense against Torah, and that's how most of us are raised. But there is an element.
That's Deuteronomy 16 in regards to Pesach, yeah, I think.
Exactly. Mm. But on the other hand, it doesn't exist, and we're sitting here with our, you know, we're sitting there with our hands crossed, and we're sitting there going like, okay, well, whatever, we're just going to sit around and wait for something to happen.
Mm.
It's a dilemma. It's an interesting dilemma.
It is. It's very interesting to think about, but we don't. Otherwise, we'll end up schmoozing again. But that, you know, we should go into detail on that sometime. But we'll return there sometime. But right now, the fact of the matter is that there is now, we don't know what this particular sacrifice is. We don't know what time of year it is. Do we? We have no.
But I think Samuel, one of the things he did was he established altars and he went around and he made sure that the service of the God of Israel was being maintained. Instead of, you know, he would go around and make sure there's no Asherah poles or statues of idols and stuff like that. That might be part of it. So here's another option. He might have allowed these altars for the time being because of the circumstances they were in.
Mm.
But he knew that this wasn't something that he approves of, but he allowed it because of the situation, and God kind of said, okay, I'm going to allow this just because of the situation you're in, but this is not the ideal.
This is not the ideal, and but if they are worshiping God sincerely, then sure. I mean, you know, this is where we are. So in any case, in verse 14, so they went up to the city after the women chattered away, and they said, you better go. Off he goes. So they went. And they, as they were coming into the city, there was Samuel coming out towards them, as if God said, hey, by the way, there they are. And on his way up to the high place, and now Yehovah had told Samuel in his ear. Do we have...
In his... Well, your translation says in his ear. It says he's in the Lord... revealed to Galait Ozen, he revealed his ear. He basically told him. So now, first of all, we're flipping now to Samuel's end here of the story. Mm-hmm. We dealt with Saul the way up here. Now we're dealing with Samuel. We're flipping to his side. And it says that he revealed his ear, not revealed in his ear. There's no be ozno, it's et ozno. Et can, one of the frustrating things about biblical Hebrew is that certain words usually mean this, but in some context they mean this, and it gets kind of in the way when I teach students. I have this wonderful student, and in the beginning he was really tense about how to translate words, and he would send me these emails with like everything the BDB says about this one word, and tell me like which one is it? I'm so confused, and I basically had to calm down him and other students as well, you know. Context is sometimes what gives it to you. So in his ear sounds kind of funny, but it's an option of translating the word et here. The word et usually means, is actually, there's no translation of the word et because it's a special particle of speech to in Hebrew. It's an indicator of an object. And for example, the Lord is the subject. Gala, revealed, is the verb or the predicate, and then et ozen shmoy, the ear of Samuel, is actually the object receiving the action. Mm-hmm. So et ozen shmoel, the et can to a certain degree be translated as in his ear, but I don't think this is what it means here.
Okay. All right, so there it is. And so I've got anyhow, so the Lord had told Samuel in his ear that the day before Saul came saying, this is the day before. He said, tomorrow about this time, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. And
well, you, you're, you're, one, you're, one, about this time. Kaed, yeah, okay. Now I was trying to figure out where you put the word kaed. Thing is that in Hebrew, the sequence of words is different than English, though. Uh-huh. So I was like, where did you put that word? Oh, there it is.
A man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him. Now get this, Yoel. Now we're talking about the first, kind of the first king of Israel, but it says you shall anoint him. I've got commander, and I know in my Jewish...
Nagid.
Nagid, that's it.
Nagid.
What is this?
Nagid. It's not a Melech. King. Yeah. It's not, it does, so this is one of the things that it's pointed out here. He is not, he is a representative of God. He is not the king himself. The only king here, and this goes back to the discussion between Samuel and God, that they have forsaken me as their king. So he's emphasizing he is not the king. He is a representative, my commander, my minister. He's not the king. Mm-hmm. And it's emphasized here.
So he could be it's a commander, a ruler, a governor, whatever it is. He's not the king. Is this the way that Jehovah describes him? But he says, over my people Israel.
And he will save them from the Philistines. So he's basically pointing out what his job is at the moment. Your job here at the moment is to deal with the Philistines. Kingship, non-kingship, oh, we'll see. But at the moment, your job is to deal with the Philistines.
Yeah, he says, for I have looked upon my people because their cry has come to me. And so even though Yoel, the people have rejected God as king and said, set a king over us, a king like the nations, he said, all right, okay, so we'll give you a king, but I'm going to give you a commander.
So the other thing is that it says, he will save my people from the Philistines. And the same kind of sentence is said about Samson. So what's interesting is both of them were killed in the presence of the Philistines. Well, Saul was actually killed by the Philistines themselves, but Samson was taken hostage by the Philistines. Mm-hmm. So there's a strong relationship here between them. Though they were from different tribes, it's just the same idea. The Philistines are basically the main enemy at the moment, kind of like the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm, indeed. So when Samuel saw Saul, wow, there's a tongue twister. When Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him,
Samuel saw, she sells seashells at the seashore.
there he is, the man whom I spoke to you about. This is the one, he shall reign over my people. Then Shaul drew near to Samuel at the gate, and he said, please tell me, where is the seer's house? And Samuel answered Shaul and said, I am the seer. So he said, go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today, and tomorrow I will let you go, and I will tell you what is in your heart. But as for your donkeys, so there it is. I mean, his eyes would have widened there. I didn't tell you about the donkeys. But the seer has said, as for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, do not be anxious about them, for they have been found. And on whom is... Now, fill me in on this, on the end of this verse. What's going on here?
And to whom is all the yearning of Israel but to you and the house of your father?
Now, how do you...
I've
got it in question marks. So it says in the
English... Yeah, it's a question. It's kind of like a question mark. It's a rhetorical question.
It's a rhetorical question. So it's a funny thing to throw into the mix, isn't it?
He tells him, well, I'm the seer, and you come with me. And then he gives him the punchline at the end.
Yeah.
And you're the chosen one, Neo. You're the chosen one. He kind of like shocks him. He goes from one stage to the other. He says, where's the seer? I'm the seer. And you know what? Come with me and have a snack. And don't worry about that. He's going from one stage to the other. He says, I'm the seer. I'm going to be your friend here. Come have a meal with me, a sacrificial meal. That's kind of an honor. Mm. And he says to him, and now he's going to prove to him that he's the seer by telling him about the donkeys. Mm-hmm. And he gives him the final punchline. He says, you're the chosen one. and you can imagine Saul's face go like, what?
And he does. It's exactly what he does. And he says that. He says, what are you talking about? Am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel? And we read, of course, why they are the smallest of the tribes, because there was that, you know, let's not go into it again.
At this point.
And my family, the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin, why then do you speak like thus to me? Now, who does that remind you of?
Who does it remind me of? It reminds me of Moses. It reminds me of... David speaks a lot about himself. It reminds me of Jacob. Last parasha we had, Katonti mikol hachazim chol haemet.
More specifically,
I'm small.
Yeah, more specifically,
Someone's who specifically? Give me a second. Give me a second there. Gideon is the same idea. He says the exact same things.
Pretty similar. I mean, I'm just looking it up now because you mentioned him at the beginning of this program, but it reminds me of him because he says, how can I save Israel? Okay, so this is Judges 6:15. He says to God, oh, my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least of my father's house. So similar.
He says very similar words.
Similar words, yeah. Just interesting.
And it's interesting that he becomes king. Well, Gideon is not really king. He doesn't declare himself as king, but and only his son reigns, and the same thing happened with Saul. Saul gets killed, but Saul becomes king, and his son aspires to be king, mm-hmm. but he doesn't really become king. So the similarities here as well.
True. Now, Samuel took Saul and his servant and brought them to the into the hall. There was a hall, Yoel, and had them sit.
Yeah, so I want to actually describe something very quickly about these high places. We're not talking about high places in the open field or something like that. It's kind of funny, but these were structures, closed structures that had altars inside them. When I looked into this just a couple days ago when I was preparing for this lesson, I wanted to really see what these things were like. Mm-hmm. And I was going over this description. They say it wasn't like the Canaanite altars that they had under trees and tops of hills and everything. This was a structure. And they actually found a few of these, and there was an altar either in an open space or with an open ceiling above it or something. Though the ceilings are usually not found. I'm just speculating here to allow the smoke to go out. But it was a structure. Mm-hmm. And next to the structure, or with the structure itself, there was a dining hall for the people who came in to eat, because basically they had to keep the place pure. These are sacrifices which are essentially built on the same idea as on the same idea of the book of Leviticus. They have to be clean and you have to be prepared to eat this sacrifice. So that it wasn't allowed for anyone to go in and eat, so they kept it inside a structure. Mm-hmm. So that's why there was a room there.
Fair enough. So that's interesting. Brought them into the hall, had them sit in the place of honor among those who were invited, and there were about 30 people there, and Samuel said to the cook, bring the portion which I gave you, of which I said to you, set it apart. So the cook took up the thigh. Yum.
Your one says cook. So by the way, the word here is tabach, and in modern Hebrew, the word tabach means cook. In biblical Hebrew, it actually means the man who does the slaughter.
Ah, really? So he's
and usually the guy who does the slaughter is usually the one who deals with cleaning the animal and everything, and mm-hmm. probably eventually cooking it. But he might have been the one that slaughters, and they had other people cooking. But he's the one in charge of the sacrificial kitchen.
He's the man.
But he's also the name here, tabach, from the word tevach, which means to slaughter.
Now, so Yoel, if he's slaughtering, he's essentially doing the work of a kohen, right?
Yeah, but these high places, it says in the Talmud that a man could build an altar in his backyard, and he can be a high priest, and his sons mm-hmm. can be Levites mm-hmm. or something. This wasn't something that you had to have specific characters to work on. Because, mm-hmm. for example, when we go to Nov, later on when we bump into Nov, there's 80 priests living in Nov, and they have an altar there.
Wow.
Okay.
So
there also might have been official altars, like big ones, official ones that priests actually worked at. But this seems to be like more of a city altar that Samuel just, when they went around, they said, oh, Samuel's coming, let's do a sacrifice. But it's also closely related to the issue of eating meat. There's a big discussion, are we allowed to eat meat that's outside of the sacrifices? There was a Karaite group that forbid eating meat. We're talking about four-legged animals, not chicken and stuff like that, but four-legged, for example, there were Karaites, and I think there still are many Karaites that don't eat chicken, by the way.
Really?
They only eat pigeons. If they follow, it's only pigeons.
Does not Deuteronomy chapter 12 make it clear that you can?
Mm-mm. The issue with Deuteronomy is that it gives you a list of 21. There's actually two lists. There's one in Leviticus and one in Deuteronomy. Mm-hmm. It gives you 21 or 22 birds, which are forbidden to eat, and some people identify the duchifat, which is one of them, as not being a bird of prey, or we usually know duchifat as like the family of the woodpecker and everything.
But that's Deuteronomy 14. But in 12, it says, from verse 20, it says, when the Lord your God enlarges your border as he has promised you, and you say, let me eat meat because you long to eat meat, you may eat as much as your heart desires if the place where Yehovah your God chooses to put his name is too far from you, then you may slaughter from your herd and from your flock, which Yehovah has given you, and so on and so forth.
But that, at the time, they, if we follow, if we say they were following Torah and what the high places they built were okay, were kosher, then it raises a question, okay, anyone can build an altar in their backyard, or anyone they have an altar, a sacrificial altar in each village, which means, oh, okay, it's not too far away from me, which means most of the meat they ate was actually meat which was sacrificial. When there was a standing tabernacle or standing altar or an official altar, which was the only place you're supposed to go to, then you're far away from it and you can eat meat. That's part of the discussion. There was a, it's a pretty old one. It's been around for quite a long time. There were Karaites back in the medieval times that did not eat meat. And that had to do either with mourning over the temple or had to do with their understanding that if it's not sacrificial meat, you're not allowed to eat it.
Okay.
And just be aware of that, that there is such a discussion in the Jewish world, specifically amongst the Karaites.
Interesting. Interesting. So we're gonna, I'm gonna pull the plug on this at verse 24, because otherwise we're gonna get into the rest of the story and it's gonna take us forever. But it's it says, so the cook took up the thigh with its upper part and set it before Shaul, and Shmuel said, "Here it is. What was kept back, it was set apart for you. Eat, for until this time it has been kept for you since I said I invited the people." So Shaul ate with Samuel that day.
That's actually good. Your verse, your translation actually is a bit more clear, because the Hebrew is slightly muffled. So it's actually a good translation of the last part of the verse.
Hey, way to go, New King James. So that that sets the scene and makes it very, very clear that there is, as you pointed out, no coincidence, just God incidents, and that the seer Samuel, he tells him about the donkeys. We find out that Yehovah has said to him the day before, "I'm going to send this guy to you," and that's even evident. He makes that evident to Shaul by setting aside the best part, which is the thigh, and putting it before him. And all of these confirmations come to him for what is about to happen. And we're going to be talking about that next week, from 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 25, all the way through to the end of chapter 10. I think, if we can do that, if we don't schmooze too long, you will.
Well, the schmoozing this week is your fault, not mine. Seriously, I have my schmoozing under control. You're the ones going wild. I mean, no.
We have been speaking to Yoel Ben Shlomo on Light of the Prophets on truthtoyou.org, truth2letteryou.org. And, of course, be reminded, dear listeners, Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page, Yoel's Facebook page, Hebrew in Israel. And if you want to get on the waiting list for Hebrew lessons with Yoel, it is hebrewinisrael@gmail.com, hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. By the way, Yoel, I like that the sunrise over the desert, the photo that you took.
Oh, yeah, but I put that on my private Facebook page.
Ah, well, you're going to have to, now that I've said it, you're going to have to put it on the other one as well.
Oh, okay, I'll do that. It's basically, I wake up very early in the morning because I got my children. They have to go to school. You know, I got a child in the third grade, child in the first grade, getting the kids out to school.
And taking photos of beautiful sunrises over the desert.
So I got up very early in the morning and I said, okay, I want to go out and breathe some, you know, fresh, cold winter or, you know, air from the desert, clean air. And I just walked down. There was a beautiful sunrise, and I happened to have my cell phone on me, so I just pulled it out and
beautiful.
Took a picture.
You're gonna have to put that on Hebrew in Israel Facebook page. And also, you've just put on a, what is it, that's a Aleph Bet song, right? A traditional Aleph Bet song.
I put an Aleph Bet song because that's the Aleph Bet song most Israeli kids, you know, back in the 80s when we were growing up, that's the song that was a classic one that we all grew up with. Anyone in my group age from, you know, kind of like, my guess is something like 20, not 20, it's 30 to 35. Hmm. That's the group age that knows the song.
It's a great way to learn an alphabet. If you're not familiar with the Hebrew alphabet, there it is on Hebrew in Israel Facebook page. My friend, thank you for coming back on to Truth to You. And a reminder to the listeners, we're kicking off next week from 1 Samuel, the end of chapter 9, all the way, hopefully, we'll get through chapter 10. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed to be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom. Kol tov.
You thought you were going to do chapter 10.
Hey, I wasn't planning on schmoozing that long. You're worse than me.
What do you mean?
You're worse than I am.
What are you talking about? You're the one who wanted to recap on the fat and the blood. And
Schmoozus Maximus.
Hey, that was good. See, I told you there was a lot in there. What are you talking about?
Yeah, there's always a lot in there. If I decide I want to talk, there's a lot I can go over. What are you talking about? I mean, I prepared these ones with a whole pile of books and, you know, storyline things, and it's not that simple. You know, I'm scared of going into the prophets because now we might do three verses at a time.